WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. We've invited Walter Isaacson back for the second part of our show to tell us more about Henry Kissinger, the subject of his new biography. We heard earlier about Kissinger's shuttle diplomacy. Now we'll hear about Kissinger jet-set celebrity. And we'll find out about what Kissinger's been up to since leaving government. Isaacson told us about Kissinger's secretive and conspiratorial approach to diplomacy. He's also been pretty secretive about the business he created after he left government. Kissinger's company, Kissinger Associates, has an office on Park Avenue, but it's not listed in the office tower's directory. There's no name on the door. Isaacson told me what Kissinger's company does.
He has about 30 clients, international firms and corporations, and he provides them he's a consultant for them. He provides them with strategic advice. He advises them about international affairs. He serves as sort of a personal secretary of state for the company and for the chairman of that company. He will travel around with the chairman or the presidents of those companies. He'll help open doors around the world. Take a few examples. Freeport-McMoRan, a large mineral and gas exploration company based in Louisiana. Not very well known around the world, but Kissinger is paid about $250,000 a year retainer to act as sort of the national security advisor and secretary of state for that firm. And he travels around with James Moffat, who's the chairman of the firm, and a few years ago they went to Indonesia together. Freeport-McMoRan wanted the copper concession in Indonesia, and it was what turned out to be a $5 billion deal over a 30-year period. Freeport-McMoRan got the concession, partly because when Kissinger arrived in Indonesia, the prime minister and all of the cabinet is out there to greet Henry Kissinger. He can get in to see them. He can bring the chairman of Freeport-McMoRan to see them. So he helped make that deal possible. Now, when I talk to James Moffat, the chairman of Freeport-McMoRan, and I talk about Kissinger's fee, he says that fee is a drop in the bucket compared to the commitment we are going to have to make in Indonesia over the next 30 years. And it makes me feel a lot more comfortable that I have Henry Kissinger on my side helping me deal when I go to Indonesia.
Now, it's still not that unusual to tune in a television panel discussion on a political issue and find Henry Kissinger on the panel. Do you think it's a conflict of interest when somebody's representing business interests abroad to also be, consulted by journalists as a foreign policy expert as opposed to as a business consultant? I mean, you wear so many different hats.
Yes, definitely. I think there's a conflict of interest there because he's very secretive. Totally secretive about his clients. In fact, in my book, I think it's the first list of his clients because the contract says both sides have to keep secret who the clients are. So when he goes on the air, for example, right after the Tiananmen Square massacre, ABC News sends up its a camera crew to interview Henry Kissinger live on the evening news. Kissinger has paid a $100,000 consulting fee to be on ABC. On the air, he says, I don't think we should have sanctions against the Chinese government. We have to realize it's in our national interest to keep close ties with China and that this is essentially a domestic problem within China. He does not say, nor does ABC News say, that he's been working with H.J. Hines, consulting about setting up a baby food factory in China, or that he's been working with American International Group, a group of insurers, America's major insurance company that has offices in Shanghai and wanted to build an office building there, and that he's formed even an investment firm within Kissinger Associates called China Ventures for companies that want to make investments in China. Now, he argues, and I'd like to give him his say here, that China Ventures never really got off the ground and that none of his opinions have ever been influenced by the fact that he had financial interests in a country. And I believe there's some truth to that. I believe he would have supported the Deng Xiaoping regime even if he didn't have a nickel's worth of financial interest in it. That's his position. That's his philosophy. But I think it would be better and there would be less of a chance of a conflict if he would at least somehow say, when he's writing his newspaper columns or going on the air, that he has businesses that he consults with who do business in China, and he's given them advice about how to do business in China, and then he can go on and say what he believes we should do about China.
My guest is Walter Isaacson. He's written a new biography of Henry Kissinger. We're going to take a short break and then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Walter Isaacson is my guest. We're talking about his new biography of Henry Kissinger. Here's the real mystery that I want you to clear up for me. How did Henry Kissinger get to be a media celebrity, and why has he so often been on panel discussions? Now, I realize he has always been an expert on international affairs and has, in fact, been making those policies, or, you know, did make those policies for many years. On the other hand, in spite of all his expertise, I have always found him to be an incredibly boring speaker on television. He speaks in a monotone, no facial expression. I mean, everything that you're supposed to be when you're on television, he's not. Yeah. And yet, you'd think that he had this kind of like animal magnetism on television, judging from the amount of time that he was used. So please clear up this mystery for me.
Well, two things. First of all, he is very brilliant in the best and worst sense of that term in understanding foreign policy, and I think that does come across. People do respect his judgments. But also, this is very important, he has understood one of the magical truths of our media age. Everybody understands that power translates into celebrity sometimes. What he realized is that celebrity can also make you more powerful, that being a celebrity makes people listen to you and take you more seriously. So he cultivated his air of a celebrity. He'd do all sorts of things, including doing the weather on CBS Morning News when he was asked to do it, partly because he tends to his reputation of being a celebrity. And it's an amazing feat. You look at other former secretaries of state, Ed Muskie, Cyrus Vance, Dean Rusk. I mean, they can enter restaurants and nobody will turn an eye. But when Kissinger enters a room, when he goes on TV, he is able to wrap himself in a celebrity aura that exudes power.
How did he become part of the celebrity class in America? You know, hobnobbing with the rich and famous, and with, you know, famous actors.
And actresses,
right, yeah. And you know, dating celebrities and everything. It's a fairly unusual set of personal relations for someone of his political stature.
Yeah, it's absolutely astounding that a pudgy refugee professor with thick glasses and a thick waistline and an even thicker accent could become the world's most unlikely sex symbol. But when he, soon after he did his secret trip to China and Nixon revealed it, he became a media star. He started playing on that celebrity, and he'd go to parties and talk about himself as being a secret swinger, and he'd get in all the gossip columns, and he started dating Hollywood starlets. He wasn't married at the time, and it's not often that pudgy Harvard professors can date Jill St. John or Liv Ullmann or whichever celebrities they want. So he loved being seen with the starlets, and he realized that that enhanced his celebrity aura, and it enhanced his power in some ways. Once when he was out on the West Coast, he asked out a very intelligent, nice woman named Karen Lerner, said he wanted to go out with her one evening, and they made a date. And then when the evening came along, he said, "I want to go see the opening of the show Gigi." And Karen Lerner said, "Well, that's not very good, because my ex-husband, Alan J. Lerner, wrote that play, and it's the opening night, and I don't want to try to upstage him by arriving with Henry Kissinger at the performance. Let's just go have a nice romantic dinner." And he said no. He sort of hemmed and hawed and broke the date and called up Jill St. John and had his first date with Jill St. John and took her there. And all the cameras and all the gossip columns the next day were about how President Nixon's national security advisor arrived at the opening of a play with Jill St. John. Now, the dirty little secret about Kissinger's love life is that there aren't many dirty little secrets, as Jill St. John says when you talk to her. He loved to be seen. He loved to be in public. He loved to be with you when the cameras were on. But once the evening was winding down, he'd drop you off. He wanted to go out with starlets, but not really go home with them. And I think it was mainly done because it gave a great thrill. to go out with the starlets, to be in the gossip columns, to have his picture taken, and to be dating Hollywood starlets. I did ask Jill St. John the question you asked me. Why would he want to be dating Hollywood starlets and going to glittering parties and with celebrities? And she paused for a long time, as if I had sort of asked, well, why would a fish want to be in water? And I guess it's sort of obvious why any of us wouldn't mind having our time dating starlets and going to glittering Broadway openings.
Do you think Kissinger was good at knowing how to use the press?
He played the press like a violin. He would call in a reporter and he would say, now you're the only reporter who will understand this, and I'm confiding in you, and I'm not going to tell anybody else in the press, but you will understand why I've done this China trip this way, and I will give you some of the secret dealings I had with Mao. And then the columnists would write fawning columns or profiles of Kissinger, and that gave him a great power within the Nixon administration. Nixon got so furious he wanted to fire Kissinger at one point, but it was hard to do because Joseph Alsop and Hugh Seide and all the columnists were saying that Henry Kissinger is the best thing the Nixon administration has going for it. So he, when he would get into his office, come into his office, and maybe he would have a meeting with Haldeman or Ehrlichman. They would tell me this tale, and there'd be a pile of phone messages. And before the meeting would start, Kissinger would go through the messages, and he would throw out most of them, but he would put on top the ones that were from major Washington columnists like Joseph Alsop or Joseph Kraft, or from Ted Koppel and Bernard Kalb and the TV people who covered him. And then he would return those phone calls before the meeting even started. And Ehrlichman would do the accent and tell the tale of Henry Kissinger purring into the phone and talking to a Joseph Kraft or a Ted Koppel and explaining some bit of foreign policy derring do that had just occurred.
You've said that Kissinger really knew how to play the press like a violin. When you interviewed him for your biography, did you ever feel like he was playing you?
He was very, very charming. He was very intent on making me understand his side of the story. But I did not feel that he was overtly manipulating me. In fact, in some ways, I was kind of disappointed because I had put up a guard, I had put a shield up. I was all ready to be manipulated, to have my arm twisted, to have him tell me I was the most brilliant biographer possible, and that only I would understand why he had secretly bombed Cambodia. And he never really did that. He treated me very professionally, and I sort of, you know, there was something in me that said, hey, why isn't he trying to stroke me and manipulate me? But I respected very much the way he treated me and the way he was professional in his dealings without trying to put pressure on me or spin me too much out of control.
I have one non-Kissinger question for you. How did someone like you, who is obviously so absorbed in the workings of government and policy, end up editing the back of the book of Time magazine, the arts and entertainment part?
I was national editor of Time magazine for about 4 years, from 1984 to 1988, did politics, and that's when I started the Kissinger book. After that, I covered foreign policy and went to Eastern Europe and the Soviet Union, covering the collapse of communism. And I guess when I got back from all of that and when I was just finishing up my book, my editors at Time felt that I needed to be a little bit more well-rounded. I needed to see a few movies. I needed to go to a few concerts and worry about science and society and the arts a little bit more. And I welcome that. It gave me a chance to do things like interview Woody Allen as opposed to interviewing Henry Kissinger.
And what was it like to interview Woody Allen? He was a troubled man when you got to speak with him.
I think that like Kissinger, in many ways, he didn't see the moral dilemmas that arose from the consequences of his actions.
Boy, I know. You know what happens when you write a biography? You see that person in every move that you make. I guess that's happened to you.
One of the interesting things that happened when I was doing my interviews for Kissinger was getting to spend some time with Richard Nixon, who's absolutely obsessed with Kissinger. He admires Kissinger, but also, as I said in the book, felt Kissinger needed psychiatric help and ordered that sort of thing. But when you talk to him now about Kissinger, he's both praiseworthy of Kissinger's mind, but very jealous that Kissinger's getting too much credit. And so he would say things like, well, I would never say that Henry Kissinger was a paranoid person who hogged all the credit, but, and then he would give me some anecdote. And even trying to interview Nixon, you see the reflections of history. I don't tape record my interviews usually, and I would take shorthand. But when I went to President Nixon for the formal interview, he said, do you mind if I tape this interview? And I said, no, I don't mind. He said, as you know, I always like to tape things. And I looked up thinking he was kind of making a joke, since he got in real trouble by the Watergate White House tapes. But he had this little tape recorder, just me and him sitting in the office, and he tries to work the tape recorder. And after about a half hour, the tape runs out, and he can't get it to work again. It's one of those micro cassettes, and he's a man who's all thumbs when it comes to mechanical objects. So after about a minute or two of trying to get it, the tape over and get it started again, he pushes it aside and says, well, I was never very good at these taping systems. I was never very good at that. And I started to smile, thinking he was making a joke, but I never was quite sure.
Yeah, he might not have realized what he was saying, I guess. Well, Walter Isaacson, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
I want to thank you for having me, Terry. It was a great show, and I really appreciated being on.
Walter Isaacson is the author of the new book, Kissinger, a Biography, and it's just been published. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.